All right. We're back in Genesis. Back in Genesis today, and we've looked at, we looked through chapter 6, all the way through chapter 6 last time. And we took a look as well last week at chapter 5, the genealogy that's there. Very important to pay attention to that. Chapter 6, 1 through 4, of course, is always an interesting passage to talk about and to walk through. And chapter 6, of course, leading up to the flood. So what's the cause of the flood? Why is the flood coming about? God says, verse 7, chapter 6, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the earth. So there's this idea of decreation that's going on. We're going to see that in particular today. We're going to look at chapter 7 and 8 and the flood itself. Okay, so that's our focus for today. Next, I believe we have two more weeks. So next week, we're going to take a look at chapter 9 in particular. We're going to talk about the covenant that's made. Why does there need to be a covenant? What are the stipulations of the covenant? But what exactly is a covenant accomplishing? It's the first time that covenant language is used. We'll chat about that next week. And then 10 and 11, the week after that. So generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, looking in particular at Shem. And Tower of Babel, of course, leading up to Abram, who will become Abraham. So before we dive in, let me open us in a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Our Father in heaven, Lord, we're grateful for your kindness towards us. We're grateful for this opportunity that we have to study this text together. Father, we're so thankful that this text has been preserved for us down through the generations, that we can gain insight into history of so long ago. We pray, Lord, that you would bless our time together. Help us to understand you better through this text. Help us to be faithful in our interpretation of the text. And Father, please give us insight that we might know it better. Help us to be an encouragement to each other as well. And we're thankful, Lord, for Christ, the work that has been done on our behalf. We pray all these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, now, before we dive in, I leave it for questions at the end, and I'm going to leave some time as well. Questions at the end on chapter 7 and 8, but I wanted to open it up just for a little bit, see if there's any questions to begin with from what we've covered before. I know I kind of raced through some of the earlier portions, and then we have 7 and 8 today. I got an extra 2 weeks from the esteemed Dr. Mark Zakevich, so that was very nice to get that. But I wanted to open it up for questions as well on what we covered last week or previous weeks, not to spend a huge amount of time on it. We do have a lot to get through today, but maybe a couple of minutes, questions that came up, or we could dive into the text. I just wanted to open that up as an opportunity. Any questions at all from what we've looked at before? Okay. Good. Excellent. Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Just a really simple review. Yeah.
I wouldn't say that that's a view that most that people would take. I mean, I don't know all of the views, so yes, I'm sure that somebody has argued that at some point. I would argue, of course, for a universal flood, one universal flood. Most scholars are going to argue for a local flood only, and we'll see why that doesn't really fit with the text. Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah.
When the flood came, yeah. Created, he reversed, I guess, the order of the water system.
Well, no, I think you mean the decreation, right? So creation is in a particular order, right? The days of creation are a particular order. And even on day 6, the animals that are mentioned, like they're created, you know, according to this list. When we get to the flood and it says, I will blot out, you know, what's breathing on the face of the earth, then it mentions it in the opposite order. And it's like it's a decreation, right? The picture is God created and made the order, and then mankind falls into sin and there's wickedness, and then God says, chapter 6, like I'm done now, and then decreates. Yeah. Oh, yes.
For people that they could be on earth. The water was below in the earth.
Yeah.
And the water was above.
Yeah.
And then in the, to create flood, that water system, he reversed it. He removed the
separation. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So is that part of the reversal that he mentioned?
Yeah, so that's another thing. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that today, in that there's an argument for what would be like a canopy theory, right? So the God separated between the water. So day two, the water below and the water above. And in the midst is an expanse, right? So he created an expanse in the midst of the waters on day two. So some people will argue, like the answers in Genesis, you know, Ken Ham will I think he takes the view that there's a canopy of water that's surrounding the earth, right? And at the point of the flood, that is used as the water for the flood. And that the expanse is taken away, basically. Yeah, but we'll talk about that. It's a very good question. Yeah. All right, let's get into the text. So let's start chapter 7. We're looking at 7 and 8. And you can think about the organization of Genesis. Genesis 6 is leading up to the flood, right? What is the reason for the flood? And leading up to the flood, chapter 7 is the flood as it's coming upon the earth, and then 8 is the receding of the flood. Okay, so you have a building up to the flood itself, chapter 7, and then a receding of the flood, chapter 8. Okay, so it's a good structure just to bear in mind. All right, let's start in chapter 7, verse 1. So Yahweh said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this generation. Now you shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female. Also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep their seed alive on the face of all the earth." Let me stop there for a second. When I'm in class teaching on this particular verse, I have my students stop, and I ask them, "Guys, what's the question that should pop out from those verses that you read that should stand way out and be like, what do you mean? What's going on? Yes. What's going on in this verse? What is the question?
Why they say seven if everybody teaches that it's only a couple?
Okay, so I have a pair of sevens, and I have a pair, one pair, right? So seven pair and one pair, right? So I have clean and unclean. So of the seven or seven pairs, I have clean and one pair of those that are not clean. Now before in 6, it's important for us to notice that God says that I will bring the animals by twos, okay? So by twos. So that's important for us to recognize. In chapter 6, it doesn't preclude it. It's not as though God changed his mind and it says, okay, first they're just coming in pairs. And now in chapter 7, it's like, oh, they're going to come by sevens now. Okay. In chapter 6, it says, I will bring the animals to you by twos. Okay. And then chapter 7 specifies, okay, now there's seven pairs by twos of clean animals and one pair of unclean animals. Okay. I always make the joke, and if you were Noah, which animals would you just... Right? Mosquito? You got to kill one of them, right? Couldn't he just done that? I'm not, you know, snake? Let's get rid of those. What's the other question, though, that should pop out here from that text? Yeah.
I'm thinking, what about all the other living things that are around now?
Yeah, yeah.
Where did they come from?
Yeah, very good question, right? How many animals are being fitted onto the ark? And then all of the, we're taking all of the diversity of the animals that comes off, or that we have today, is from the ark, right? So like we're all descended from Noah and his wife. So also every animal that's alive today, that's living, breathing on the earth, right? Fish are not included in this, but every animal that's living, breathing is descended from one of those animals that came off the ark. Yeah. So we have all of our diversity today within the genes of the animals. Last week I talked about I have a white lab at home, right? All the different varieties of dogs that we have, there's only two dogs, right? There were, or whatever it would have been, two wolves. I don't know what it was on the ark. Right now I would assume that the animals looked quite differently. But one other question, One other question that should pop out in those verses. Yeah.
I think the opening where I don't know what the exact question would be.
Yeah.
But the righteousness that he saw
yep.
in Noah.
Good.
You know, it's like yeah. how did that righteousness come about? Like,
yeah.
the only one.
Right. Yeah.
That whole generation.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And last time in 6 we were looking at it's chapter 6 verse 8. It says, first, Noah found favor in the eyes of Yahweh. And then in verse 9, it says Noah was a righteous man. So the question is he finding favor and then he becomes righteous? Or is he righteous and, you know, he finds favor by that? It's in an order. I tend to see the idea that he finds favor with God. God grants him grace and then he becomes righteous. But there's a question in the text.
But grace comes first.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in any case of Noah following after God, the grace would have had to come first. And I think that's a particular illustration of it.
So is it true to say that he did not impart grace to anybody else in that generation?
There's his common grace, which is given, but at the flood, that common grace is taken away. Yeah. Noah's wife finds grace. His sons and their three wives find grace. But we're going to see, it says, There's a particular point. If you're thinking of like the climax of the flood story, there's a particular verse that says they all are on the ark and God closes the door behind them. And it's at that point, it's like there's not grace anymore. It's the end. Yeah, we'll see that in just a little bit. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've always been a little bit troubled when I read Noah and his entire family.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a situation like that.
Right. Right. And it doesn't even describe his sons. Right. So it says Noah finds favor. Noah is righteous. It doesn't describe his wife. It doesn't describe his other sons. We get some insight into his sons in chapter 9. And we see two of them seem to be fairly righteous just in the description. One of them, not so much. Right. So it doesn't describe them. It's just that Noah's righteous. Noah finds favor and his family is blessed because of that. Yeah. Clean, that exactly. That's the question that I'm looking for, right? Clean and unclean animal. This is the question that I ask my students in particular. Okay, so you shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean. This is the first time in all of Genesis, the first time that this is mentioned, that we have clean and unclean, right? Leviticus is going to take this, you know, to further extremes, right? This animal is clean, this animal is unclean. Don't sacrifice this animal, you can only sacrifice this animal. Don't eat this animal, you can only eat this animal. Okay, so it's going to take it more to the extremes. It's my daughter in the back there. Dad, what are you talking about? All right, but this is the first time clean and unclean is mentioned. And in fact, it doesn't even use the Hebrew word for unclean. You can see it in the text. In verse 2, it says, you shall take with you every clean animal by sevens, or every kind of clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean. Okay, it just says no clean, not clean. There's a separate Hebrew word for unclean that's used particularly in Leviticus. That's not used here. It just says clean and those animals that are not clean. So you ask the question, this is the first time I have clean and unclean mentioned. What's clean and unclean?
When did they become unclean?
When did they become unclean? Is this something that was in the creation before, as God created it? Is this something that comes about because of the fall? Is this a different reordering or a reorganization of the animals into category of clean and unclean because of the fall? What exactly is the meaning of clean and unclean? Okay, so I ask that to my students in particular. Sometimes it throws them off. Sometimes they get it. Okay, sometimes they ask a very good question and say, "Oh, right, this is the first time clean and unclean has come up." And sometimes they don't, and they're looking in the text trying to find like some hidden mystery or some secret thing. I'm like, just look at the text. It says clean and unclean. What is clean and unclean? Now, there's no description that's given. So notice when Yahweh is talking to Noah, he doesn't say, okay, this is what I mean by clean. This is what I mean by unclean. There's no description of that that's given. No further explanation. Just like either Noah already knows what's clean and unclean, or Noah learns what's clean and unclean when they come to the ark. This group comes in sevens, they must be clean. This group comes in only by two, they must be unclean. Yes, ma'am?
Could be unclean one that are the
predators? No, no, no. There's not a separation with predators and prey. We'll see when we get to Leviticus further elaboration on it. But I want to explain or think through. I'm not going to get into the law and, you know, the Mosaic law and all of that, but where is this coming about? Why do I have clean and unclean in my text? Where is this coming from? Okay, and Leo asked a very good question, right? When is this starting? When is clean and unclean beginning? Okay, and I want to expound a little bit on this and talk a little bit about this. Where is clean and unclean coming from? Okay, these are two very particular categories, okay, that Noah either learns or already knows about. Okay, there are two particular categories. And there's only two categories. Okay, it's not like there's clean, unclean, and really unclean. It's just two categories only. When we get to Leviticus, when we get to the Mosaic law, we gain further insight on clean and unclean. There we gain some more explanation as to why are things categorized as clean and unclean. What's the point of doing that? Now, of course, in the Jewish, you know, dietary system, okay, you can only eat clean animals. You have to eat kosher animals according to the Old Testament. Now, there's all kind. I lived in Israel for a couple of years, and let me tell you, there's all kinds of other additional laws that have come about from those dietary requirements that really don't have anything to do with the Old Testament. Okay, some rabbi says that, you know, a cheeseburger, right? You're never going to look in the Old Testament and find, oh, the cheeseburger is forbidden. Okay, the cheeseburger comes about as being forbidden in Jewish law later on because of various reasons, okay? Now, why clean and unclean? So as we examine, I'm going to talk a little bit about this idea, Leviticus, and we're going to help, it'll help us to understand kind of what's going on here, okay? So I have in Leviticus, I have in Torah, further description about why something is clean and why something is unclean. And I want to explain this in a sense in three levels to you. I hope that it's helpful for me in my own brain. That doesn't always mean that it's helpful for you, okay? I think in weird ways. My wife always tells me that, but I think in terms of three different levels, okay? At the top level, let's say, we're talking about someone's nature. We're talking about someone's heart, okay? Do you have an evil heart or do you have a good heart, okay? Is your nature one of evil or is your nature good? Are you following after God or are you not following after God? Okay, so it has to do with someone's heart. Okay, what is your nature? Coming out of that is what that, let's say, person does. Okay, so you will know a tree by its fruit. Jesus picks up on the same idea. Okay, you will know a tree by its fruit. What's the nature of the apple tree? Okay, that's first level. What's its nature? It's an apple tree. Therefore, it produces a particular kind of fruit, okay? A good person produces good fruit. An evil person produces wicked fruit, okay? So I have the first level, what's the nature? What's the person's nature? Good, evil, following after God, not following after God. Then on the second level, I have what's coming out of that. Okay, what's deriving from that? That's where I have where the law is really speaking to. Sin and righteousness. Sin and righteousness. An evil person does sin, does transgression. Okay, where I can actually count up the sins. In the sense of I lied four times today. Okay, I didn't actually lie four times today. But I broke these many laws in these ways. Okay, so an evil person will take the law and it will and will purposefully transgress the law. So Paul, when he's talking about the law in Romans, he says the law was brought in order to multiply sin. Okay? Before the law came, people were still evil and good. Okay? Noah is someone who follows after God, who is saved. Okay? It doesn't mean he's perfect. It means that he does what is good. Okay, and then you have evil people within the world. So you still have good and evil before the law comes. But when the law comes, I now have a way to measure what someone is doing as wrong or right. Okay, so I have a way to measure and say, all right, you did this thing wrong. You murdered, you lied, you committed adultery. I'm measuring, the law is measuring and saying, here, let me show you the sins that you're doing. Okay, within the real world, within the tangible world, relationships that we have, laws that we break, okay? The third level that we have is clean and unclean. And clean and unclean has to do with how sin is creating effects within the world, okay? So it's not the individual sin that I do, but it's the way in which sin causes effects within the world. Stick with me, okay? This is a little bit, but stick with what I'm saying. The first category being good and evil. What's in your nature? The second level being, if I have a good nature, I do what's righteous. If I have a bad nature, evil nature, I do what's wicked. And then clean and unclean comes in after that and says, well, what would the effects of sin be? What would the effects of sin be? Okay? If I am ceremonially clean in Leviticus, and I touch a dead animal, I become unclean. Why? Because death is a result of sin. Death is a result of the fall. If I accidentally touch an unclean animal, I'm not sinning, okay, but I'm becoming unclean. Okay, I have the effects of sin that are touching me, if you will. Okay. Here's one of the laws that that sometimes I'll get questions on. If a woman gives birth, she is unclean for 30 days. You say, what's wrong with giving birth? Right? Why would you be unclean for 30 days? This is a good thing, right? Have children. It's a mandate, right? Be fruitful, multiply. So why is giving birth an unclean thing? Because you're producing someone who's a sinner. You're producing someone who's going to bring more sin into the world. There is nothing wrong with giving birth. It's a good thing. But it's bringing about the effects of sin in the world. Okay? It's bringing about the effects or more effects of sin within the world. If a woman gives birth to a male child, she's unclean for 30 days. If she gives birth to a female child, she's unclean for 60 days. Why 60 days? Why? Because not only is she giving birth to a female child who that young girl will sin herself, but that young lady will grow up to have more children who will also be sinners. So she's unclean for 60 days. Right? Is there something more wrong with having a female child than a male child? Absolutely not. I have two beautiful daughters. Is there anything wrong with that? No, it's not sin. It has to do with the effects of sin within the world. Okay, it has to do with the effects of sin. Does that make sense? I have at the first tier the question of good and evil. Are you or do you have an evil heart or do you have a good heart? After that, I have the effects of that individual. I lie, I commit adultery, I murder, I steal, I whatever it is. That's the effects of sin within the world. That's someone who is producing sin within the world. Okay, that's sin and righteousness. Past that, I have clean and unclean. And clean and unclean is only the effects of that sin within the world, okay? So sin brings about certain realities within the world, death, separation, those sorts of things, okay? And by bringing those effects about, I now have a category of clean and unclean. I don't want those effects of sin to cause me to be unclean. Okay? You see the three tiers. Yes, ma'am. Question? Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what Moses points to when he is in Deuteronomy. So he's speaking to Israel in Deuteronomy, and they say, oh, we'll keep the covenant of God, right? Oh, yeah, no problem. They do the same thing in Exodus. And they say, well, Moses comes to them and says, all right, here's the stipulations, right? Here's the stipulations. You need to abide by the rules of the covenant. And they say, oh, that's no problem. Piece of cake, right? We can do that. Yahweh's our God. We can keep it. We can keep the stipulations. They were only thinking in terms of keeping laws. They were not thinking in terms of, I have an evil heart that needs to be dealt with. I have a major problem here. They were thinking, oh, sure, I can follow some laws. That's no problem. And in Deuteronomy, at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses pinpoints the problem. Right at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses pinpoints the problem and he says, you keep saying that you're going to follow the law. You keep saying, I'm going to do what's righteous. I'm not going to sin. You keep saying this, but you can't. There is no way for you to do that. Why? Because you have an evil heart. You need to change your heart. So I have the new covenant come in and saying, I'm going to give you a new heart, Jeremiah and Isaiah. Okay, I'm going to give you a new heart. That means that from that new heart, you're going to do what's righteous, naturally, okay? And from doing what's righteous, the effects of sin are mitigated within the world. So you're exactly right. Everyone is born into sin. Everyone who is born with that evil heart, it's God who changes that heart. Leo?
So in with the flood, God is bringing a new, he's judging.
Yeah. Right. It's a very good question. It kind of goes back to my joke about squashing the mosquito, right? Why couldn't you just squash the mosquito? Why leave the unclean animals, or why bring them onto the ark at all?
Unless it's a master plan at the end.
Yeah.
If we're just judging and then bringing a new beginning,
right.
Why are we still having these?
Yeah. We're going to see a couple key instances in 7 and 8 throughout Genesis 1 through 11. But in 7 and 8, we're going to see a couple of really key places where it's God showing grace. So Noah comes on the ark, and you say, okay, Noah's righteous, okay? He's righteous. His sons are not described as being righteous. And you don't need three sons, right? You need one son. And you need one son who's married, okay? So you don't need three sons. Why is Ham coming on the ark? Why all three of them?
Someone needs to run the ship.
Somebody's got to hoist the sails, right? No, there's no sails on the ark. But it's a demonstration of grace. Okay, it's a demonstration of grace. So we have a decreation that's going on. So the floodwaters come, and I have a decreation that occurs. Destruction, worldwide destruction. Okay, but it's not the exact same thing as a decreation only. Okay, it's a decreation that's infused with God's grace. Oh, I'll preserve Noah. Oh, I'll preserve Noah's family. Oh, I'll preserve the animals as well. Oh, I'll preserve even the unclean animals. Oh, I'll preserve. So there's the thread throughout that's showing grace in light of it. Let's take a look at verse 4. This is one of our first instances in chapter 7 and 8 of this happening. For after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. After 7 days, God gives them a stopwatch and says, hey, guys, you've got 7 more days. 7 more days. Okay? So he takes the chronology. We'll talk about the chronology of the ark. You have Noah, you have his family, you have those that are coming into the ark. They start or they begin to go into the ark in these 7 days. So Noah's building the ark for 100 years, right? Probably maybe less than that, but Okay, he's building the ark for about 100 years or so, and 7 days before the flood comes, he doesn't know the exact timing, but 7 days before the flood comes, God comes to him and says, Noah, 7 more days, and then I'm bringing it. That it's at that point, they all start moving onto the ark, okay? But notice that 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth, okay? 7 more days. That's very interesting to me that God would give grace in a time frame. Can you imagine how Noah's preaching changed? Noah's preaching for 100 years. Noah's preaching for 100 years, both by a really great illustration of building a boat, but also just preaching the truth. Judgment is coming. You all are living in sin. You need to repent. He's preaching for 100 years. How does Noah's preaching change when he hears from God and God tells him 7 more days and the flood's coming? And Noah starts saying, hey, guys, you know what? You know what I heard this morning from the Lord? 7 more days and the flood's coming. Okay? They're given time to repent. Not even 100 years of time to repent, but they're given 7 particular days, right? To say, change your ways. Nobody listens. There's no one listening to Noah. Yes, ma'am. No, I'd be very careful to like read anything into seven's, you know, it's the days of the week, a completion. So God does choose 7 days. It doesn't say in 6 days. So in 7 days, so it's a full, you know, it's a full cycle. So I'm giving you a week to repent, but I wouldn't try to read too much into that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Regarding that Noah was preaching.
Yeah.
This anti-Bilibian world.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. See, that's a good question. Going back to those three tiers that I talked about, Paul, when he talks about this group, right, in Romans, Paul says, all right, we have the law given, and the law stipulates, do this, do this, do this, don't do this. But he says, but even before the law, they knew what was right and what was wrong, because it's written on the heart. That's part of his argument, part of Paul's argument in Romans. It's written on the heart. They knew. They knew that their heart was evil. They knew that they were doing wickedness. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time, right? And they knew that was the case. So Moses, Noah, calling for repentance, they understood what he was calling for.
So that's considered your conscience.
Yeah,
conscience.
Right, right.
Right,
exactly. And also the fact that someone is created in the image of God. When you're created in the image of God, you have a particular function, right? You're going back to that, what we talked about with being good at creation. God says, this is good. I create man, and it's good because he does exactly what I created him to do. After the fall, I have a fracturing of that. And you can understand what that fracturing is. When you do something that's wrong, there's a breaking that goes on. I'm not supposed to be doing this. This is wrong. I know this is wrong. It's not only is it not producing good results, but I know I shouldn't be doing this. I'm acting against the way that I was created to act, right? So they absolutely understood their wickedness. All right, let's continue on. In the text, my time is going to, we've got a lot to talk about, okay? I'm going to, let's talk about the chronology as we move through. So after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. I will blot out from the face of the land everything that I have made. And Noah did according to all that Yahweh had commanded him. Notice that same phrase back in 622. Okay, 622 and this verse here. Noah did exactly what God created him to do. Okay, just like in creation. Good means you're doing what God created you to do. You're doing what God commands. In the same way, Noah did exactly what God commanded him to do. All right, verse 6, Noah was 600 years old when the flood water came upon the earth. I had a question from somebody a couple of weeks ago about calendars, okay, calendars before the flood. Now, we know we have sun, moon, govern the day, govern the night. There's calendars. They understood, okay, a year has passed by, okay? There was some kind of calendar system before the flood. We don't know what it was. Okay, we don't know exactly what it was. The calendar that we see here, when it talks about this month, this day of the month, it appears to be a calendar of 360 days. Okay, so 30 day, 12 months. Okay, that's what it appears to be, though it's hard to say exactly. But notice that the calendar doesn't say in 3022 BC. It says in the 600th year of Noah's life. Okay, so it's basing the time frame on Noah's life. Okay, so when we read 600 years old, when the flood of water came upon the earth, after that it'll say in his 600th year in the second month of the 17th day. Does that mean when Noah is 600, 2 months and 17 days old? Or does it mean on whatever calendar that there was, the second month of that calendar, the 17th day of that calendar, Noah's 600 years old in that year? Okay, you can take two different ways. We're not sure what the calendar system looked like beforehand, but we know there was some kind of calendar system beforehand. All right, so Noah's 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood. Now, that's an overarching statement. We're going to get more description later on, okay, taking them in. They come to the ark. Okay, Noah's not out on a horse with a lasso, like trying to get a bunch of animals. Okay, they all come to the ark. We'll see in just a second. Now, of clean animals and animals that are not clean. See, again, it doesn't even use the word unclean. It says of the clean animals and then the animals that are not in this category of being clean. The birds and everything that creeps on the ground, by twos, they came to Noah into the ark, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. So they came, God commands the animals, they come to Noah, whichever of the animals that God selected, they came to Noah to get into the ark. Now it happened after the 7 days that the water of the flood came upon the earth. Now in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on this day, all the fountains of the great deep split open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain came upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. The idea is a collapsing down, okay? That you don't necessarily have to hold to canopy theory. At this, I go back and forth on canopy theory. At this point, I don't hold the canopy theory because of how creation is described on day two, okay? But I'm not going to throw stones at anybody that holds to that, okay? Just throw that out there, all right? But either way, there's a description of the water collapsing down. If I have an expanse and I have dry land and I have people living in atmosphere in dry land, I then have water coming up from underneath and I have water coming down from on top. I have a collapsing down. In other words, there's nowhere to go. Okay, there's nowhere to go. The ark is the only way out, the only escape. Okay, the fountains of the great deep split open and the floodgates of the sky were open. Those are two particular pictures, okay? Two particular metaphors that are used, okay? So the fountains of the great deep, right? We all understand the picture of the fountain, right, coming up. It's like God says, let me open up these fountains. From underneath, water is coming up. Okay, and the floodgates of the sky. It's a particular word, a particular idea that's used there. Like God is opening the windows of heaven. Okay, it's a similar word for windows. And it's like he just opens the windows of heaven and down comes all of the water. Okay, so the floodgates of the sky and the fountains of the great deep. Now, verse 13, on this very day. So for those 7 days, very good question from before, right? I have 7 days where God says the floodwater's coming in 7 days. Okay, so we have a process of 6 days in which animals are being loaded onto the ark, taken onto the ark. Food is already on the ark. And then I have Noah on that very day that it starts to rain. My argument from before when we saw in creation is that it hadn't rained before. It says that there was a stream that came up from underneath the ground and it watered the whole face of the earth, so it never rained. It's like LA, just with water, okay? It never rained beforehand. So when people start feeling raindrops, whatever that looks like, when they start feeling raindrops, much like in LA, they're saying, what is going on? What is happening here? Okay, I would argue that they had not seen or experienced rain before. Okay, so 6 days animals are loaded onto the ark. On that seventh day, God says, I'm gonna make it rain on that seventh day. I'm gonna make the flood come on that seventh day. On that very day, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, Noah's wife, the three wives of his sons with them, entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all the cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, every bird after its kind, every fowl, every winged creature. Okay, so that's my full description. Who all is on the ark? It's fitting into that category. Okay, every animal that God brought. So they came to Noah into the ark by twos of all flesh, in which was the breath of life. Those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded that one, and Yahweh closed it behind them. Okay, the picture being everybody gets on the ark. Noah gets on the ark. He doesn't pull the chain to bring the door up. I have no idea how big the door is. I'm sure it's quite large. Okay, he gets on the ark, and Yahweh is outside the ark, comes up to the ark. Everybody's on the ark, closes the door behind them. Okay? The picture is that God's the one who's closing that door behind them, and God brings judgment across the entire world. Verse 17, then the flood came upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. You will often get an argument from different scholars that this is some kind of hyperbole. It's some kind of, in history, it was a local flood that happened, and then it's just like, it's hyperbole, like it's exaggerated for the sake of effect, for whatever reason, to talk about some theological truth. Okay, but the argument would be, well, this didn't actually, it's not a worldwide flood. It's just something that was like a local flood, something that happened. There was somebody named Noah, maybe, and then it was just exaggerated after that. Okay, that's not how the text is describing it. The flood came upon the earth. There's no way to take that word earth as different. The text, either you agree with it, what the text is saying, or you don't. There's some things that the text leaves out. We don't have all the details. We don't have all of the explanation of the minutiae. But what the text says, you either hold to it or you don't. It's not trying to be ambiguous. Okay, the text is saying the flood came upon the entire world. There's no way to take it differently within the text itself. Water multiplied and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. The water prevailed and multiplied greatly upon the earth, and the ark went on the surface of the water. So it floated, right? First flotation test passed, good to go. My wife and I, we kind of like Leo, right? We enjoy sailing, and we were in... My wife's from Florida originally. We were in a little tiny dinghy, and we were going out to this sailboat, and we're in this little tiny dinghy, like two-person dinghy, and start up the engine and start going out on the water. And we notice that the front of the dinghy is doing this, and every time it does this, a whole bunch of water comes into the dinghy, and so not a great moment. Right, got to turn around, sink or swim. Okay, so it floats. The ark went on the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains under all the heavens were covered. Doesn't say how high those mountains are. Is Everest? Everest is not necessarily here at this point. Does that come about later? How high are the mountains? Unsure. We don't know how high all of the... what the highest mountain was. Ararat is mentioned as a place name later on, right? But the mountains themselves here are not mentioned. It says the water prevailed 15 cubits higher and the mountains were covered. Now, let's talk about a time frame for just a second and kind of lay out what's the timeline look like. Okay, so again, the calendar is based on Noah's life. So 600th year of Noah, That's what it's, and then at the end, when we get to the end, he's going to be 601. So he celebrated a birthday on the ark. Happy birthday to Noah, okay? It's based on his life. God gives a 7-day warning. I have water coming. That's the beginning of my flood. Water starts. And then I have 40 days of rain and water coming up from the ground. Okay, 40 days of water increase. Don't necessarily think that the water all came at one time and the tops of the mountains were covered all at once. Okay, it would have taken a while for the water coming up and coming down to build up such that the mountains are covered. We don't know how much time that was. Okay, but it starts to rain, water starts to come up from the ground, and how long does it take for the water to build up to this level? If 40 days, apparently, that it rises. So I have 40 days of the water rising. Okay. Verse 21, and all flesh that moved on the earth breathed its last. That is birds, cattle, beasts, every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, as well as mankind. All in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, of all that was on dry land, died. And that word there in particular, like suffocated, breathed their last. Verse 23, thus Yahweh blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky. Right? That's the opposite order of the creation. So when we have the creation spoken of and what order is he creating, that's the opposite of it. Okay, so he first creates the birds before in terms of animals, other than the fish. He creates the birds first. Creeping things is mentioned after that. Then the word for animals here, then man after that. Now I have the opposite. Okay, man, animals, creeping things, birds. So a creation up, decreation down. They were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah remained and those who were with him in the ark. And the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Okay, so I have an increase of water 40 days, and then I have included in that 150 days would be those 40 days. So for 150 days, okay, I have water that is, as it's described, prevailing on the earth. Okay, 150 days. From the start of the flood until God sends this wind that we'll speak about in chapter 8. All right. Verse 1, chapter 8, verse 1, and God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. Now that word, we talked about God repenting or relenting or being sorry that he created mankind last Sunday. Okay. This word, think in tandem, right? God is sorry that he made mankind in chapter 6. God knew exactly what was going to happen. God knew that mankind is going to fall into sin, that they're going to rebel against him, and that at some point he's going to send the flood. He knows exactly when that is. He knows all of those details. God still creates. Man does exactly what God knows that he's going to do, and God wipes him out. Okay, so God was sorry that he created man. Verse 8, or chapter 8, verse 1, God remembered Noah. He remembered Noah. He didn't forget him and then suddenly, oh, hey, Noah's down there, right? It's not as though he forgot. The word is he remembered. He brought it to mind and he said, yes, I am still working with Noah. I'm demonstrating grace to Noah. Never forgot about Noah. He just remembers Noah. He remembered his promises to Noah. God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. What does that look like? A wind to pass over the earth. The earth we're taking in the same way, right? So if we said this is a worldwide flood, water covers the earth. When it says that a wind passed over the earth, that's the entire earth. So what does it look like for a wind to pass over the entire earth? I don't know exactly what that looks like, but it's a wind passing over the entire earth, okay? And God caused this to happen, and then the water begins to subside. So I have 150 days from this time that it starts raining, 150 days, water's prevailing on the earth. Now I have God sending a wind, remembering Noah, sending a wind, and the water begins to decrease, okay, after that 150 days. Okay, the water subsided. Also, the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained. And the water receded, or you could read, it began to recede from the earth, going forth and returning. The idea is like a wave, okay? Goes out, comes in. Goes out, comes in. But every time it goes out, it's a little bit reduced, okay? So think of it like a wave, like the tide. Okay, you go to the beach, okay, wave comes in, goes out, comes in, goes out. Well, eventually you notice it's going out further and further, okay? That's the picture being painted on going forth and returning. At the end of 150 days, the water decreased or began to decrease. In the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. Okay, and it's that 150 days that we're taking. Okay, so 150 days, the ark rests on Ararat. Who remembers how tall the ark was? I'm a teacher, so I give pop quizzes all the time. Okay, 30 cubits. Okay, it's 30 cubits. Okay, how high was the water from the mountains? How much did it go above the mountains? 15 cubits. Okay, so the water is above the mountains 15 cubits. I have an ark that's 30 cubits high. How much does the ark displace? Okay, so I have 150 days of the water increasing. I have the ark sitting in the water, let's say 12 to 15 cubits. Okay, and I have the ark, even at the height of the water, I have the ark that's pretty close to the top of or tops of the mountains. Okay? Because it's displacing water. So on the seventh month of the 17th day of the month, the ark rests on the mountains of Ararat. Interesting that the name is given, because you're like, well, where's this? We haven't heard of Ararat before. We don't know what's in reference here. We have an Ararat today. We have the mountains of Ararat today. And Jews reading this Torah at the time that they're going into the Promised Land would have known, oh, right, Ararat is that region. Okay, so was it called Ararat at the same time? Did it gain the name Ararat after? Okay, but it's putting it in a particular location. Same name.
Okay, so,
yeah.
So in the plays of Gilgamesh,
yeah.
The same thing, they call it Mashu.
Yeah, yeah.
Which mm-hmm. is the two peaks.
Yep.
So
right. Yeah.
Like so that's what I want to always like understand why mm-hmm. because culturally it's the same area.
Right.
How did they, you know, where did the name come from?
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And notice where is it? Okay, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. So it's in the plural. So Ararat is a whole region. Okay, so if I have other, like, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that are wrong with Gilgamesh, but even if I have like two peaks, particular area, they're just saying, well, this area within Ararat. Ararat is a whole region. So it's saying it came to rest on the mountains of Ararat, not claiming which one that it was. Yeah. Be like saying it rested somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. Ararat's a much smaller area than the Rocky Mountains. It's like it could have been anywhere within that region. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, yeah. So there's a region Ararat, but there is particular a Mount Ararat, right, which is the tallest in that area, which is why it's you know, it just takes the name because it's, you know, the most prominent one within. But in the text, it's saying the ark rested on the mountains, plural of Ararat. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be the Mount Ararat. It just is within that region. Okay, now the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. Okay, in the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains appeared. Okay, so I have, this is a question I'm going to bring up a little bit later. I have a period of 150 days, okay, so 150 days from the beginning of the raining until the peak of the water, okay, and then I have 2 months and 2 weeks later, after that 150 days, that the tops of the mountains start to be visible, okay, so I have 178 days from the time the water begins until I have the tops of the mountains that are visible, okay? We'll come back to that in just a little bit. Just keep that in the back of your mind. 178 days from the time the flood starts, okay, until mountains are visible. And again, it would take some time for the water to build up such that all of the mountains are covered. Okay, so how long, how many days is it that the entire world is covered in water, can't see any land? How many days is it? Okay, it's less than 178. All right. Then verse 6, it happened at the end of 40 days. So 40 days after this, the mountains become visible. Noah doesn't know that the mountaintops are visible necessarily. Okay, the way that it's depicted in the ark, he's not like out on his balcony having a cup of tea looking at the view. Okay, he's not seeing. It says he opens a window, okay, that previously apparently wasn't opened. It happened at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. He sent out a raven. It went out flying back and forth until the water was dried up from the earth. So it never came back into the ark. Okay, then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of its foot. The tops of the mountains were visible, but it says, I'd rather go back to the ark. So it returned to him into the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. He stretched out his hand and he took and he brought it into the ark to himself. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent out a dove from the ark. And the dove came back to him toward evening. And behold, in its beak was a fresh olive leaf. Fresh olive leaf. So let me come back to the olive leaf in a second. So I have 150 days, okay, from start to rise, peak of the water, 2 months and 2 weeks after that. So 178 days from the start of the water until the mountains become visible again, or the peaks of the mountains become visible again. Okay, 40 days after that point, Noah sends out the raven and the first dove. And then 14 days, he sends out the raven again twice. So 7 days later, 7 days later, another 14 days. Okay, and then we have a timestamp after that of the 601st year within the first 601st year of Noah's life. Okay, verse 13, chapter 8, verse 13. Now it happened in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Okay, so Noah is 601 years old. Either he's 601 and it's his birthday today, or he's 601 and there's some calendar that's in use before, right? It's first month, first of the day of that month. Okay. And then Noah removed the covering of the ark and he looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. It's not until that point that he gets a view. Okay, so he has a window, but the window isn't necessarily showing him anything. It's a way for the birds to come in and out. Okay, and then it's only at he removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the whole surface of the land was dried up. The water was drying up. Okay, after he removes the covering. Okay, and then he removes the covering of the ark, let's say the top of the ark, and it's only 1 month and 26 days later that he actually leaves the ark. Okay, God gives them the command. So they have a month and 26 days that we'll see in a second where they're looking around and saying, okay, water's at this level, here we go. All right, and then let's go out from the ark. God gives the command at that point. Okay, so in total, I have 1 year and 10 days from the start of the water falling until they exit the ark. 1 year and 10 days. Now, let's go back to that freshly picked olive leaf. Okay, two things that I want to talk about here. We'll see how our time does, okay? I might leave a portion of this for next week. Let's talk about two things in particular. Freshly picked olive leaf and a raven and a dove, okay? Let's start with a raven and the dove. He sends out a raven, and then he sends out a dove after that. Now, if the text would have said he sent out a bird, you were like, it doesn't matter what bird it is, it's just being ambiguous. It doesn't matter what kind of bird that it is. He just sends out a bird, the bird goes out, can you see if it's dried up, comes back in. But the text says in particular that he sent out a raven. Why does he send out a raven? Okay, it doesn't explain it, doesn't say this is the reason why he sent out the raven. But why does he send out the raven? A raven in Leviticus is described as being an unclean animal. Okay, so I have only two of them in the ark. Two ravens in the ark. You can take a look at Leviticus 11:15. Okay, Leviticus 11:15 says, don't eat the raven. Raven's an unclean animal. So he sends out an unclean animal first, assuming that this is the same categories that were, or very similar categories that we're using for Noah and for the later to be established Mosaic law. Okay, so the raven's unclean. There's a couple places in the Old Testament where ravens are spoken of very well. Okay, who remembers a story about ravens? In good terms. Elijah, right? So Elijah in 1 Kings 17, he's such a great character, just goes up to Ahab and says, hey, it's not going to rain, and he just walks away, okay? And he goes away, and Ahab's like, who was that crazy guy? And then it doesn't rain, and it still doesn't rain, and it still doesn't rain. He says, I really need to find that guy, Elijah. But when Elijah comes, and he says, hey, it's not going to rain, and then he leaves, says he goes down to the brook Cherith. Okay, and while the brook is still flowing, he's drinking from the brook, and it says that ravens brought him bread and meat every day to eat. Okay, they just dropped it overhead, I guess. They're flying on, and just, here you go, here's your lunch. Okay, I wonder if they came at the same time every day. I wonder how many ravens there were. I wonder what kind of meat it was. Doesn't explain any of that. Okay, are they they're dropping him steaks from Ruth's Chris or something? I don't know. Okay, but they're spoken of well there, okay, 1 Kings 17, verse 4, you can read that. Okay, they drop bread and meat, but also ravens, again, they're an unclean animal, and they're carrion eaters. I think that's why a raven is sent out, okay? Why? Because it eats dead flesh, eats dead things. That's why it's unclean as well, okay? Because usually its primary source of food is dead flesh. Okay, Proverbs 30:17 describes the raven that way, a few other places in the Old Testament. But I think it's sent out because of that. But again, it doesn't explain it in the text for us. Leo?
So in that section where God said, okay, I'm gonna bring this many clean animals and this unclean.
Yeah. If for consumption would go into that, right? You're not allowed to eat these animals. That comes later, though, because they're not eating any of the animals in the ark, but they're unclean in the sense you can't eat them, but also I would say, like, within themselves, they're in the category of unclean.
So, but they became unclean because the earth got corrupted.
Yeah.
And sin got in the world.
Yeah.
After Adam getting kicked out.
Yeah.
Right. Now, right. Some of these animals, just like humans, are getting corrupted. Evil sin is coming in. So they are eating those. Like, is that how they became unclean?
Yeah.
That's what's happening. Because now you need these animals,
yeah,
to clean up that,
yep,
body, that, or the insects,
sure,
et cetera, to,
yeah,
clean the earth.
Yeah. You're asking a very good question. You're asking a particular question because when we, let's say we go to Leviticus and we actually dissect and say, these animals are unclean, these animals are clean. We can ask the question, or Leviticus helps us to understand why we have clean and unclean categories generally, but it doesn't always give an explanation as to why is this one animal in the unclean category and this one animal in the clean category. If we understand the purpose of clean and unclean, then I think we get a general understanding that this animal is unclean because it's interacting in particular with something that's the effects of the fall, a raven eating dead flesh or something to that effect, but it's not always explained, right? So the animal that splits the hoof and doesn't chew its cud, you're like, well, what does that got to do with clean and unclean? Like, there's some particular things that are given there. And for some of them, they fit very well. You're like, I could see why that would be unclean. But for others, not sure. Right? That's the whole, like, do you eat pork? Do you not eat pork? And there's all these arguments, right? Well, pork, they're bottom eaters. They eat trash. They, you know, whatever. So don't eat it. Is it only dietary? That's a whole other debate. The whole other animal. Okay? Yeah. Maybe after this series, we'll do a series in Leviticus. Huh? Who's up for that?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. It was semi-resounding. Okay. All right. Let me go back to that freshly picked olive leaf. So, just to summarize, with the raven, I think, though it's not stipulated in the text, I think that the raven is sent out because the raven, it's an unclean animal, yes, but it survives on carrion. It survives on dead things. And so Noah's thinking, yeah, you got a good chance to make it out there. Go ahead. But he sends the dove after. Dove is used all over the place. The dove is a symbol of peace. It's used in Song of Songs extensively, right? One, the lover calls the beloved, you know, by describing her as a dove in all of these different ways, right? So it's apparently, you know, it's a beautiful animal. It's a clean animal. But in any case, it's especially after this point, it's representing peace, right? The Holy Spirit represented by a dove. Freshly picked olive leaf. This is a question that I've had for a while. What happened to the vegetation? Noah takes the animals into the ark, and Noah has, because the Lord tells him, he has the foresight to collect all of the food for the animals on the ark. We don't know exactly how many animals were on the ark, but we know that Noah had enough food for all of them. They all went onto the ark. Apparently, they all survived. And they get off of the ark. They probably have food for a little while after getting off the ark as well. But how can you have a dove fly out of the ark and get a fresh olive leaf in its mouth and bring it back to Noah? Okay, what happens to the vegetation? We always have this in mind. What happens to the animals, right? How do the animals survive? How do they fit on the ark? But what about the vegetation, right? What happens to the vegetation? Now, that's very important for our chronology. I mentioned Answers in Genesis before last week as well. I like a lot of the work that they do, right? There's some really, really intelligent people, Answers in Genesis. They helped me out with this. They pointed to a couple different articles and things from various scientists. Now, again, let's talk about the chronology. So I have 150 days from the start until the water is at its peak. I have 2 months and 2 weeks after that the tops of the mountains become visible, in which vegetation could theoretically begin growing again. Okay, tops of the mountains. I also have the water starting at that 150 days, and it's not for some time that the water is over the tops of the mountains. So I have a period of time less than 128 days, right? I'm mixing all my dates, but you see where I'm going with this. Okay, I have a period of less than 128 days from where vegetation is not able to grow on the earth. So what happens to the seeds? What happens to all of the plants? Okay, how do they survive? How do I have vegetation? Even as Noah is sitting on the ark, sends out a dove, dove comes back and says, hey, here's a fresh leaf for you. Okay, it didn't say a fresh olive. Olives take a while to grow. Okay, but it has a fresh olive leaf. So there's Answers in Genesis does a really good a job. There was an article that was published in 1968 by a scientist named Howe, H-O-W-E, and Howe did a whole bunch of tests and said that 140 days was as long as that he could find to where he would put soak a seed in water, leave it for 140 days, and after that 140 days, it was still able to germinate, right, and to last. Okay, so I'm not a botanist, but I always had that question in my mind. Well, what about the vegetation? Okay, so I have a couple of different answers for that. First of all, possibly I have seeds that are being preserved in dead animals that are floating on the surface, or debris that's floating on the surface. Possibly, okay, it goes down, it's planted, it grows. I possibly have Noah taking seed with him on the ark. I know that he has feed for the animals. So as the animals eat feed and then they go out of the ark, they're putting that seed back in the earth, okay? In a polite way to put it. I have also seeds, at least possibly some seeds that are able to last through that period of water, that time period of water, coming down onto the ground and being planted. Okay, so it's not crazy. There will be a lot of arguments, there have been a lot of arguments saying, well, there's no way vegetation could grow. But I think there's some good arguments to say, yeah, it can. When Noah opens the ark, okay, it's not, oh, look, a lush green forest. It's like, oh, look, there's a sprout over there, and there's a sprout over there. This is good, okay? But obviously the vegetation, the vast majority of the vegetation is destroyed at that time.
But God's sovereignty.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Right. And preserving in some way, right?
He took, with the animals on the park, he took the two fish and the eight loaves and he fed 5,000, mm-hmm. Just sovereignly ordained any of that.
Yeah, right.
And spoke it into existence.
Yeah.
Just as he did in Genesis 1.
Right. Now, we see there's sometimes a faith versus science is always pitted against each other, right? Like you've got faith, but science says this, okay? We would argue, though, that the faith that we have, the truth that's communicated in the Word, is represented or can be represented well within science. Like science can account for, if it's done correctly, can account for this sort of thing happening, a global flood. In fact, we would say that what we see correctly interpreted within geology, within the layers, which in all of these different things, shows us the flood, right? So we see a God at work. We see a sovereign God at work who knows exactly what he's doing. We also see a God who's working within the world himself, right? He tells Noah, build an ark. He doesn't just bring Noah up into heaven and say, hey, sit up here for a while this happens and I'll send you back down. Right? He says, build an ark. Food. You need to collect food for yourself. We see this very interesting relationship between the two. Like, Noah, you need to go do this. You need to go collect food. You're going to need food for a year. Go get it. And get on the ark and build the ark. And so we see a God who's working within the creation as well.
And I just checked, it takes about 40 days to olive seed.
40 days, yeah. ChatGPT?
The word 40 is used in terms of days.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the prophets was on his side for 40 days.
Yep.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's used extensively.
I mean, probably, at least 40 or 50 verses in the scriptures about the number 40.
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of a number of completion, like 7. It's not, don't take it allegorically. It's 40 days, 40 literal days, right? But it's used extensively as a selected period of time.
A lot. A whole file of 40.
Yeah.
In my
right. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
It could be that that the Bible is written for us.
Yeah.
And always is using something that we know.
Yeah.
Because we are the ones to explain everything. Mm. But always is in God's time. He's working in his own time.
Yeah.
Then maybe he's doing everything, but we can understand.
Yeah.
How he do it, but everything is in his own time.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. But it's good to see it's all of the timestamps that we get for the flood. We see all of the description that comes about for the flood, that this is God's in control of all of this. It begins to rain. It stops to rain. Water recedes. He sends the wind. He says, get off the ark at this point. Right? So it's all within time. We're talking a global flood and very much controlled by the Lord. Very good. Okay, I'm going to leave verses 20, 21, and 22 until next week because there's so much to talk about within that, just within those three verses. So I'll leave that for next week. 28, 20 through the end of 9, we'll take a look at in particular next week. So last little section I want to look at, 13 through 18, or excuse me, through 19 of chapter 8. And then I'll stop for questions as well at the end. So 601st year, first month on the first of the day, waters dried up from the earth. Noah removes the covering. The surface of the ground is dried up, okay, but they still are staying on the ark. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry, okay? And then God spoke to Noah saying, get out of the ark, you and your wife, your sons, your wives with you. Man, I bet they were really glad to get that command. Huh? Like, how tired would you have been of being on that ark? I need some space. Like, what's the first thing to do? They just walk off and like, okay, you go over there for a while. I'm going to go this way. I'll see you in a month, right? bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm the earth, be fruitful, multiply on the earth. We see this reiteration again of what's the purpose. God created with a purpose, with an intention, and part of that intention when he created the animals in day six was be fruitful, multiply. Said the same thing to the birds, same thing to the fish. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. This is the point. This is your purpose of what I've created the animals to do. Okay, so he gives this command. We see creation taking place. We see the evil of man, and then we see a decreation take place in which God says, "We need to. I'm going to reset everything. We're going to start over, and we're going to start over with Noah and his family." But notice the similarities, right? That they may swarm on the earth, be fruitful, multiply on the earth. This is the same that we had before, right? I gave you those commands at the beginning. Let's do it again. Okay, let's do it again. And we're going to see next week additional stipulations which are given. And that's the key question that we have to ask. Why are these additional stipulations given? We're going to talk about whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood will be shed. We're going to see all kinds of new stipulations which are given in this, in a sense, reset of the world. Why are those given? Why is there a covenant given at that point? Very important. Topic to talk about next week. So Noah went out, his sons, his wife, his sons' wives with him, every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by their families from the ark, right? That's interesting, by their families, okay? They're by twos, by their groups, by their families. It's interesting that it calls it families. It's not just Noah's family, but the animals even described as being within families. Okay, so we still see that order, that creation order, taken into account. All right, I have a whole host of things to talk about for verses 20 through 22, but I'm going to leave that until next week because I'm very close to out of time, and I don't want to rush it. We've got a little bit of time. So next week, we'll take a look at 8:20 through the end of 9, and then the week after that is chapters 10 and 11. We've already talked a little bit about the generations of Shem at the end of 11. But let me open it up for additional questions. You've already asked some excellent questions of the text. Additional questions. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's a very good question. How many people heard, right? The text doesn't specify. It doesn't say necessarily that everyone on the earth heard or everyone was required to hear. Part of the question is how, like, population. We don't know exactly what the population of the earth was when the flood came. I would say that it's not near the population that we have today by any means. But you have those statements of, like, Adam and Eve, they had Cain, they had Abel, they had Seth, and they had other sons and daughters, right? And it doesn't say how many other sons and daughters. By the time Adam dies in his 900s, I mean, does he have 100 sons and daughters? It's really hard to tell. So how many people were on the earth at that time, and how much had they spread out? Because the tendency that we'll see in the Tower of Babel is that they're all coming together. Tower of Babel happens after the flood, but you see this tendency to group together, which they're not supposed to do. So if they're all grouping together in 1, 2, 3, 4 locales, we could assume that over the course of Noah's preaching, everybody's going to hear, hey, there's a crazy guy in that place over there who's building a giant boat. We're not sure what it does. Yeah, it's a very good question. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Could you explain, like, from the beginning of creation?
Yeah. So in the creation account, we have on in chapter 2, Genesis 2, we have this explanation of the water coming up from the ground. It says that there was a stream that rose up from the ground to water the surface of the entire earth, okay, all the dry land. And it says a particular statement there that God had not yet sent rain on the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground, which is the explanation given for why there's no weeds and there's no cultivated plants. This is in chapter 2. So the garden is created. It gives all that description in 2 of the, you know, the waters and the four rivers in the garden. So the idea is that before the flood, everything is watered based on these waters coming up from the earth to water the surface of the ground, and that rain only comes at the flood.
So when it mentions in, like, I guess that's 5:17,
yeah,
flood waters, how is flood water, I'm reading flood waters on the earth, how did that, how would they know what a flood water was?
Right, yeah. I would argue, again, it's a bit of an argument, and we're not exactly sure, but I would argue that they wouldn't know what rain was. They would theoretically know, okay, well, there's water falling from the sky. But they did understand that God has created and separated the water from the dry land, right? So I have dry land and I have this over here, ocean. So they viewed, understood, this is what ocean is. This is what dry land is. And so flood waters coming onto the ground, it wouldn't have been impossible for them to understand. Yeah. I don't think they had experienced rain, but I think they knew when Noah's saying flood water's coming, they understood what he's talking about.
So is it, I just one last question.
Yeah.
Like the water cycle.
Yeah.
So you're arguing the water cycle wasn't built into the original creation?
I would say not like opposed to dew or those sorts of things, but the water is, once it comes up from the ground, okay, it's watering the surface of the ground. And then does the water evaporate at that point? Is it going back into the ground? I'm not sure. So I'm not dogmatic on saying like there never was rain before the flood, but it seems that way from the text. Yeah. Yeah.
Might it be like the geysers at Yellowstone?
Well, yeah. I mean, in particular, it says that in chapter 2 that the water came up from the ground, right? Water doesn't normally flow up. So there's got to be some kind of, you know, it's a spring or something that's pushing the water up onto the ground. Yeah. Yes, sir.
The Genesis 1, verse 6 says that God said, let there be expanse in the midst of
yeah.
the water, and let it separate the waters from the water.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That would speak for a canopy of water.
That's, yeah. Yeah.
And one thing that started me thinking is we fly a lot to China.
Yeah.
And we flew over Urumqi, the desert.
Yeah.
And when you fly over there, you can clearly see that there's been rivers there.
Yeah.
You see how mountains were solved, like I think it's described in Job.
Yeah.
And you can see how new mountains were formed.
Yeah.
What God described to Job after
right.
he retreated the waters.
Yeah.
Yeah. 18,000 feet.
Yeah.
You have Siberia in the north and the Himalaya in the south. There's never any rain there. It's mm-hmm. one of the driest deserts in the world.
Yeah.
Very high. It speaks so for this flooding. And
yeah.
Not only that, but I live in Austria and the Alps, they in the tops there.
Yeah.
They even find the sea fossils.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And then from this, I came to North Siberia.
Yeah.
Where they found tropical animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were all of a sudden frozen. And that speaks for a canopy of water. Because what happens is if you have a canopy of water, there's only one real greenhouse gas, and that's water.
Mm.
And if it covers the whole world, that would create an one atmosphere from the North Pole until the South Pole.
Yeah.
And that would also explain that if that water is being retreated,
yeah.
all of a sudden you're introducing a huge temperature difference.
Yeah. Sure.
All of a sudden frozen.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden you're creating a poles and an equator with the tropical
all sure. his homes there.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there was a Baptist preacher, yeah. and he was serving in northern Canada, and he was talking to geologists, and they were describing that there's a tropical forest underneath the North Pole, and all the trees there, they have all of a sudden collapsed and layered on top of each other into the same direction.
Yeah.
And they were all tropical trees, and they were all of a sudden moved into one direction, so speaking for a big flooding, and they a big retreat from water.
Yeah.
So all these things speak for a canopy of water, and it's really nice and interesting to look into this, because it would support the whole Genesis.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I would agree that there is so much evidence to show, evidence that's only explained in terms of a global flood. Right, in the movement of water, and a different, you're exactly right, a different ecosystem beforehand. When we talk about the, I'm going to run out of time here, but when we talk about the ice age, right, ice age is thrown around, if you have, or I should say, what are the perfect conditions for an ice age? A whole bunch of water and temperatures to reduce slightly, right? So they're at 32, 30 degrees, you know, zero Celsius, -1 Celsius. Like they're at only that, you don't have to have -40 Celsius for the ice age. You have to have a whole bunch of water in the atmosphere that doesn't know where to go and fairly reduced temperatures. And that's what I think we would see after the flood. And then after that point, so the flood comes and now I have North Pole, South Pole, it's a different ecosystem, and I have a whole bunch of water that is being turned into snow.
And then this water is also reflecting radiation. And that could also be the reason why people got that all before the
sure, yeah.
If you want, I can send you the pictures.
Yeah, no, no, absolutely, that would be good. That would be great. The only reason... I'm going to run out of time, but the only reason that I go back and forth on the canopy theory in particular... I would hold obviously to a worldwide flood, but the canopy theory in particular, that there's a canopy of water that surrounds the earth, the only reason that I don't hold that right now is because in the description of the days, so on day two, it says God created an expanse, 1-6, right? Waters below and the waters above, which is a good, like, okay, we have a canopy above, but then it says on day four that he placed the sun, moon, and stars in the expanse. In that rakia, in the expanse itself, which that's the only reason at this point that I'm not holding to canopy theory is because of how the creation is described on day four.
But it's from the perspective where you look at it. If you look from the earth, you see the skies, and you see the stars and the sun there.
So. Yeah. You see all the debates, right? This is what we do. We just, you know, can it be taken this way? Can it be taken that way? Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's really nice
yeah.
Because you see that
oh, yeah.
It's really
yeah.
It speaks for everything in Genesis.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's good. Very good. Okay. Yes. Well, one last question, then I'll let you go.
Well, this is a quick question because it's probably not going to be a fast answer. Okay. But I've read quite a bit where prior to the flood, we had Pangaea.
Yeah.
Where all the planets, all the continents were together.
Uh huh. Yep.
Yep. It looks now.
Yep.
And but if you look at the Atlantic Ocean, Google Maps, and you can see the ground and the shape, there's a crack down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean from the North Pole to the South Pole.
Sure.
A big crack, and it just seems to me like maybe all the water came out from there.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I do think that in terms of the land mass. When it says that God created the dry land, he separated the dry land from the water. It says the gathering, the one gathering of the water he called seas. And so I do think that there was one land mass. Okay, the earth was comprised of one land mass and then one ocean, which is surrounding that land mass. So how the continents are coming about after, is that a result of the flood or is that a result of something that happens after the flood and just continental drift or what exactly does that look like? It's a good question. We'll see it when California breaks off and we just float out into the ocean. We're like, see, it happens. It happens. All right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right.
Sounds like that might.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a description of Peleg, who is born, and says, in his day, the earth was divided. And there's a bunch of debate. What exactly, what do you mean by the earth was divided? In what way? Yeah, we'll see that. All right. Come next week. We'll continue on at 8:20 and with more questions and more time in the text. I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.